Okay, so there's a few ways we can do this. You know, a bad way to do panel discussion is when no one has any questions and you sit there and look at each other. It turns into a staring contest, so we don't want to do a staring contest. So there is some material that I could walk through that really traces basically three steps towards leadership development. And it would do a historical case study, and then it would do a biblical case study, and then it would do a contemporary case study, one that comes right out of our church, a seven-year process of someone that went from student at the university to now one of the elders on our team. So he's one of the pastors at Gospel Grace Church, and we kind of trace that. So there's a handout. Did everybody get a handout? The first part of it is just basically those three movements, and we could spend some time talking through that if you'd like. There's three appendices in the handout. One has to do with an internship. What would an internship look like? How would you frame that if you wanted to develop one in your church? Here's one model. It's not the only model, but it's one model. What would an elder candidacy process look like? So we put an outline for that. What would that look like? And then the last one is ordination. And that is, here's fascinating. I don't know if you've found a book on ordination. You've probably been to a few. So then it's your turn to host an ordination council, or you're burdened to see men ordained. You know, you read Titus or you read Timothy, you're burdened to see men ordained. What does that look like and how would you go about it? And there's a sample in there for that. So that's the handout. I could spend a little time on that, or what we could do is open it up for questions. So maybe we could do this first. Let me just gauge the audience. How many of you have come to this session and you do have some questions? If you say, I've got something on my mind, I see one hand. All right. There's one. We put a few questions in here, too. So maybe if you look on page number six, these are just ones that
it's the only ones we know answers to.
Yeah. So we just put a few on there, just to start the conversation if we needed to. There's nine questions on there. Those are some we could hit.
I would say kind of just, why don't you just go through this a little bit.
Okay.
And then as people have questions, like just notate them, or if you look at those questions at the end, and that kind of sums up what you're thinking. But it'd be awesome to be able to talk about what you want to talk about versus just staring at each other.
Okay. So let's do that. I'll start with a historical case study. I spent some time about a year and a half ago researching Calvin's Academy. In Geneva. And how many of you have spent any time reading about that? Okay, one of you. Yeah, it's a fascinating study. It's a fascinating study because of how it plays out. It was fascinating to me and one other person. It's a fascinating study because of how it plays out in the Reformation and really the impact it had on turning the tide, specifically in France, in some of the missional endeavors there for Protestantism. And so what I wanted to do on this first thing is just see if I could summarize some of those salient points from this study on Calvin's Geneva Academy, because the point of it was this. It was not merely to create an educational institution. Calvin's Academy was really intended to be an instrument of training pastors to send them out. And that's why I think it's so fascinating to study. So how did he do that? And why was he so burdened? And then what was the product that he had? I was reading the registry from the Geneva Consistory of pastors there. And you read this registry. I came across this entry. It's fascinating. They're sending someone to Brazil. And I thought I misread it. So I look again. You know, here we are in 1500. Nope, that's what they're doing. They're sending a missionary to Brazil from Geneva. And I was just fascinated to see the missional endeavors that were taking place out of this pastor training factory. And one of the things that I would just say, these brothers sitting next to me, one of the things we all share is a desire to really obey Titus 1 and 1 Timothy 3. And that is to see elders trained up. It is not wrong to import elders. Right? I mean, because Paul imported a few to a few spots. Like, hey, Timothy, go over there to Ephesus. Titus, head to Crete. So, I mean, he parachuted a few pretty skilled elders into those spots, right? But if that was the only way that elders were formed, it wouldn't have been sustainable. They had to raise up elders. And so we sat at a conference a number of years ago. We sat at a conference, and Thabiti, whose last name I will not try to pronounce, but you know who I'm talking about. Thabiti preached out of Titus chapter 1, and I remember sitting there just listening to Titus chapter 1, and the thing that struck me was this. Paul tells Titus to go to Crete, and you know what they say about Cretans? The Cretans are liars, evil beasts. Come on, say it in the King James. Slow bellies. Lazy gluttons, okay? Slow bellies. I always loved that phrase. You know, slow bellies. Lazy gluttons. Evil beasts. Liars. He says, go ordain elders from among those people. And that struck me so deeply because here we are and we're in Salt Lake City, the heart of Mormonism. And it might be easier to try to say, let's go visit some of the seminaries and Bible colleges and see if we can bring people in to be elders. But it's probably not a sustainable model. What has to happen is we need to train elders up out. And I think that's what really fueled me looking into what did Calvin do in Geneva? How are they training elders so that they could have this pastor factory? We would love, I mean, I think that's a willism. You know, I think it's a word that will, a pastor factory. What if we could have a pastor factory in Salt Lake City? So maybe just glance down at a few things. Maybe I can highlight from the Geneva Academy, 1559, this crown jewel of John Calvin. He didn't want an institution, he wanted an instrument for training pastors and missionaries. It's probably not a coincidence that the Geneva Academy launched on the same year that he finished his final revision to the Institutes. Calvin thought he was going to die. He was very, very sick. He writes about it. He thought he was going to die, and so he wanted to do two things. He wanted to leave behind the Institutes. And the reason... You know, what is fascinating, institutes now are this, it's a book, or if you have the two-volume set, it's a book that people argue about, but maybe don't read some of the things that he says in there and his passion for writing it. His passion for writing the institutes, this is what he says. He says, my object in this work has been so to prepare and train candidates for the sacred office, for the study of the sacred volume, that they may both have an easy introduction to it and be able to prosecute it with unfaltering steps. That's what he writes in the introduction to the Institute. Why do you write the Institutes? He wrote the Institutes so that pastors could be good pastors. That's why. And whether you agree with everything he said in there or not, he had this vision of training pastors. So he wanted to write the Institute and he wanted to start the Geneva Academy. And he thought he was going to die, and those are the two things that he did. You know, and I think it's fascinating. He didn't end up dying. He was very sick, but he didn't end up dying. But he wanted to leverage his life to write, teach, train, and prepare men for the ministry. And it all came out here in this 1558 near-death experience that he had. What he wanted to do is he wanted to train men to go and lead congregations so that they could be reformed and grow and mature in the faith of the Word. What's beautiful about this time period, for those of you who are like history buffs, what's beautiful about this time period is that the Bible was coming to the language of the people. And so he wanted to train ministers who could take the Word to the people, and the people could mature by understanding and growing the Word. And because of this time in theological development and the maturing that was taking place in the church, what happened is congregations were getting tired of having informal preaching and ill-trained ministers. So back up. So prior to the Reformation, what would it have been like to go to church? Give me some descriptors. Prior to the Reformation, what would it have been like to go to church?
Latin.
What's that?
Latin.
Okay, Latin. Right. I mean, it would have been Latin. It would have been incomprehensible. Why? Because, well, you don't speak Latin. Congratulations.
Censoring.
Yes. What else? Anybody from this side? What would it be like to go to church?
Not vibrant.
Okay, not vibrant. Yeah, a lot of deadness there. A lot of deadness. Do you know, this is, if you read like Erasmus's, has anybody read Erasmus's Praise of Folly? Okay, we got two. Yeah, do you remember the satire that he uses? Threaded throughout this thing to mock some of the brokenness of the Catholic Church at that time. Specifically, these priests. I mean, these priests, they were immoral. They had children running around the villages that were from the priests. Priests couldn't read. There were a lot of priests that were totally illiterate. Did you know that? They bought their position, or their family bought their position. They couldn't read a lick. So they memorized some things in Latin. Like, just think about this for a second. You're going to go preach on Sunday. You know, just memorize it. And just say the same thing over and over again. Nobody knows what language you're speaking in anyways. That's what it was like. E pluribus unum and carpe diem. And, you know, I mean, can you imagine that? That's what was going on. These guys who couldn't read, who had memorized some Latin, were speaking to a bunch of people who didn't understand Latin. And that was your church life experience. Well, now, with the Reformation, the scriptures are being translated into people's common tongue. And not only that, but all of a sudden it's being taught in their language with Luther. I mean, think about the Germany and Calvin with France and here he is now in Geneva and all these things are taking place. The churches are maturing and they were no longer content with preaching that was informal with ill-trained ministers. They wanted guys who knew how to handle the word. Well, how are those guys going to get trained? And that's what brings Calvin to start this academy. He wants to train men to be able to preach in these things. There's this, we're at the bottom of page one. In 1561, the last line, in 1561, the church at Nimes indicated that there were only 10 ministers for 54 churches. There was this shortage of pastors. And he's trying to solve that problem by training men. The mass had been abolished in certain places. Catholic clergy were being removed. Reformation doctrine is infiltrating these different congregations in Europe, specifically France. In order to fill these vacant pulpits, men needed to be trained. So what churches were doing is they were sponsoring some of their guys to go get trained to be pastors, which is beautiful. You know, here we are in the middle of 1500s, and these churches are like, we want someone who can preach the word, so we're going to sponsor you. We're going to pay for you to go to Geneva and get trained. And that's what was happening at that time. If you look about halfway down on page 2, you'll see from 1559 to 1620, more than 888 French students, matriculated into the academy. What's fascinating here is that these people were getting trained and then they were crossing back into France. So France was dominated by Catholicism. These men were being sent up to Geneva. They were getting trained and then sneaking back in. They have this underground railway of transporting pastors back into Catholic France. And so one writer, Karen Mogg, she writes this. She explains, Geneva's main export was ministers, principally headed for France. And so the missionary movement that occurred in France here at this time was really being fueled by the training of pastors, training leaders. I mean, that's what the point of this session is about. It's about really being burdened to see that the future of the church is connected to the training of church leaders. And the training of church leaders can't be merely relegated to a Bible college or a seminary. Now, obviously, you know that Geneva, he was pastoring at that time, too. So this is not totally disconnected. The Geneva Academy is not disconnected from the church. Actually, many of his teaching lectures were done in the church that he pastored, that Calvin pastored. It was ecclesial theology he was teaching. And so what happens here is they train these pastors, and the Reformation doctrine at the bottom of page 2 was exported to the Dutch, to the English, to the Scots, to the Germans, and to the French. Martin Luther said of Calvin, he said this, "This is certainly a learned and godly man." And he said that because of the way that Calvin was writing and investing his life into the training of churchmen. He preached more than 4,000 sermons in Geneva. He taught theology, lectured 3 times a week. His health began to fail. This is top of page 3. It began to fail, but he wouldn't stop. He had friends that tried to tell him, Calvin's friends tried to tell him, hey, why don't you dial that back a little bit? And this was his response. What? Would you have the Lord find me idle when he comes? And so he had people carry him around on a chair so he could get to where he needed to be to lecture and train young men for pastoral ministry. And from his bed, he wrote lectures and letters. What? Would you have the Lord find me idle when he comes? And so all the way until his death, but he's dictating his will. He says this, I have endeavored according to the measure of grace that he has given me to teach his word in purity, both in my sermons and writings, and to expound faithfully the Holy Scriptures. And he did this in a context of investing into men to be future leaders of the church. So if you want a historical case study of leadership development, then this is just one of the fascinating ones, and probably some things that we could learn today about training people for ministry. Okay, so should we pause?
I have a question.
Yeah.
I know you've got some other case studies coming, but would there be one or two points that could be applied today that we get just from the Geneva School? Like, is there anything that's unique about this particular example as opposed to the ones that's coming? So we just pause here.
Yeah, I think Calvin saw, he was someone who didn't have his head buried in the sand in his own need in Geneva. He really could have done that. There was enough turmoil in Geneva. If you read his biography, you know he even got kicked out of Geneva. At one point, he stood in front of the communion table and wasn't going to allow them to take communion. Do you guys remember the story? Anybody remember this? He wasn't going to allow them to take communion. He's like, "You can lop off my arms and my legs, but I will not give that which is holy to that which is profane." Because what they were doing is supposedly interpreting Acts chapter 2, where it says they had all things in common. Remember that? And they were, does anybody know what they were doing in Geneva? They were swapping spouses in Geneva, having all things in common. Nope. He said, "Nope, you're not going to take communion." And they kicked him out for it. Yeah, they kicked him out of Geneva. So I say all that to say this. There was enough problems in Geneva, just like there's enough problems in wherever it is that you live, to put your head down and just say, "Listen, I got enough going on right here. I can't really think about the greater cause or the greater mission. Or I can't really, like, listen, I'm barely treading water. I'm drowning here. Can I really invest anything into someone else?" And I think he could have, he could have said that. But he really had a longer look and a wider scope of vision that I think I think it's helpful for us to consider. And that is, although you may feel like you're drowning, although you could, barely keep your head above water, you probably need to think next steps. And God has entrusted things to you in your ministry that he intends for you to pass on. I think that's, so, I wrote this before Phil preached, but the next one is a biblical case study for leadership development. It's all of 2 Timothy 2, right? Yeah, so he did a great job. Just get right over this. But 2 Timothy 2 too, right? I mean, do that. Yeah.
So this question sort of been running in my mind the whole conference. How much does somebody need to, how much character does someone have to have? How much do they need to know? The things that come to my mind right away, okay, they need to be qualified if you go to the qualification passages. Maybe they need to, be well-versed in our 10 main doctrine sort of subgroups that we teach in our seminaries. At what point, can I start training these 3 seventh grade boys? That is pretty much what I'm working with so far as, like, potential spiritual maturity in my church, and say, at what point will they know enough that I say, "Hey, yeah, let's plant a church. You're ready for this."
So maybe I'll do this. I'm going to repeat the question, and then I'm going to let some of these other guys maybe chime in on that. Okay, so just for the recording. So the question is, like, how do we gauge the level of maturity, or how do we know how much needs to be invested or they need to know before they would be ready to engage in this process? Did I capture that okay?
They're ready to, essentially ready to pastor.
Okay, until they're ready to pastor, what would be some of those benchmarks or thoughts that you have? And you guys have something you want to share?
So when is the seventh grader ready to pastor?
So even anyone, you go yep. and you witness yep. to a guy, you share how you've heard stories of guys, getting saved and they're pastoring, a few years later. So what's necessary?
I'm going to say one brief biblical point, and then I'm going to let Jonathan jump in, but there's an interesting, I don't know if you guys picked this up with Titus and Timothy, where you have the qualifications for eldership. And one of the distinctions, do you remember one of the distinctions between the two passages? When he talks to, do you know Luke? Yeah, no? Okay. Luke has the answer. He's just not going to share it. One of the distinctions, there's distinctions between them, but one of the distinctions is that when Paul writes to Timothy about Ephesus, the context of Ephesus, he admonishes him to lay hands suddenly on no man, right? Don't be quick to do this. He doesn't do that with Titus. Did you pick that up? He doesn't do that with Titus. And perhaps the reason there is because the churches were so, there really was no one that had been saved a long time on that island. there was no one at that juncture. So that's one of the ideas where there may be a little bit of difference depending on the context as far as, is this a timeline? I don't know if it's a timeline. We do have that warning, though, with Timothy. I don't know, Jonathan, what were you thinking?
I was just thinking through like some of the grid that we work through when we're doing intentional leadership development through our internship is we have 6 or 7 things that we want to see true about someone so that before they're even go to the ordination step and affirmed as an elder, and then in our context, we want to see church planners sent out. There's some things that are unique because your question was about not just pastoring but planning a church. And so I can maybe just list what those are. And John, you think you can write them on the board maybe?
Yeah.
What?
Either or.
Yeah, so theological competence, spiritual character, philosophy would be team church planting. Doesn't mean the whole team are a team of elders, but you have to. There's some team dynamics that you want to examine. So is this person someone who has good ministry and team compatibility? Practical ministry skill. Family life and health. And then the last one has more to do with our context, but probably is true in any context you're going to plant a church, and we call it contextual acuity. So it's someone, so for example, in Salt Lake, where we're at, there might be someone who's maybe wired to maybe plant or pastor a church in rural USA. And not even setting those against each other, like planting a church in Salt Lake is better than planting a church in rural Iowa. Some people are wired more for a particular context. And so if you don't do well in an urban environment, it's something maybe you could grow in, but we want to examine the acuity or contextual acuity. Do they really fit into the unique dynamics of Salt Lake City urban center with the presence of a false religion and those kind of things? So
do we normally throw calling in there too somewhere?
Yeah.
Calling.
Yeah.
Where's calling? It's at the top.
Yeah. You can probably circle the main word. Calling, competency, character, compatibility, chemistry.
Yeah. You probably don't want to share all that list with a seventh
contextual
grader,
acuity. Yeah.
Chemistry.
But
I think obviously qualifications are going to guide this. That's why we have those lists, right, for 73 and Titus 1. Qualifications are going to be there.
You talk about formal education in the context of the children, too.
Mm-hmm. John, did you have something else to say before we move on to that one?
I say that, if we're talking at seventh grade level and at intern or preparation for ministry level, there's two different types of ministry that's going on, but there's no different command to equip the saints to do the work of the ministry. And so being able to communicate what word ministry looks like in a young believer, in a seventh grader to a seventh grader, what does it look like to do word ministry for a middle schooler? What does it look like for them to learn to read their Bible and then to speak the word to another believer? What does it look like to listen to a prayer request from a brother or sister in Christ and actually put your arm around them and pray for them? So I think there's an aspect to all of this that goes before it where there's a life in the church where normal ministry is taking place throughout believers one to another at every stage of life, And that significant eternal ministry takes place between two believers when they share the word one with another and when they pray for each other. Valuing that, praising it, teaching them how to do it, helping them do it and teach other people how to do it. I think that's like that the dumb moment that we all know, but being able to say that's huge, that's wonderful. Do that more and more. And we love it when you do that in the church. That's I think behind the that's part of the pathway from seventh grade to later.
The education piece is probably very difficult. Just repeat the question for this.
What was your question?
Just specifically for the 20-year-old guy in the church who's passionate, who's gifted, and who's not in college classes. How does formal education fit into that idea of preparedness for ministry?
Okay, so the question was how does formal education fit into someone that's maybe 20, hasn't even gone to college, and how do they fit into being equipped for pastoral ministry. Typically, we've worked with people that have had at least a college degree, just basic living, right? What some have had a seminary degree that have partnered with us, and then there's quite a few right now that probably the majority now don't, and they're having to. For us, it's difficult because most everyone has some measure of bivocationality. So now you have job, family, church ministry, and now educational ministry. And so some have to do less of one to be able to get the other done. Some are, you know, some just can knock it out. Some are great with it. And it's a case-by-case circumstance. I think what would be most ideal is if there was some form of educational institution in Salt Lake City for us. That would, because then you'd be localized. So then you'd have people from Utah getting saved, perhaps going to the University of Utah, or maybe even going somewhere else for an undergrad or something, but they're getting that seminary degree within the church to plant in Intermountain West. That'd be the best long-term plan. There's no, there's absolutely zero evangelical seminaries in Utah. There's one up in, about 4 hours away in Yellowstone, but it's a broader one. There's one down in Las Vegas that's really broad. So Phoenix, Denver, and then if you were to count the adjunct,
Wyoming.
So, I mean, like here is a great blessing for people in right here in Michigan where you can serve and go.
Maybe just a point to follow up on that. It seems like if they're going to be an elder and the skill they need to have to be an elder is to be apt to teach, then they better have a well from which to teach. So poor learners are rarely good teachers. And so I think there's a danger in taking a 20-year-old and bypassing education. It doesn't mean everyone needs to have a degree hanging on the wall, but most people are not self-disciplined learners. There's a few. I mean, some of you in here might be that. Like, you are just a disciplined reader and a student and a writer, but most people aren't, and they need the educational process to help them be disciplined. The other thing is that most people don't know how to formulate a scope and sequence that helps them get the education they need for ministry, and that would be the value of an institution that's done it for a long time. They say, well, this is what we think you need, because we've watched this happen, and we've worked with men, and this is kind of it. Most guys intuitively aren't going to come up with that on their own. So, you know, the things you've heard of me among many witnesses, the same commit to faithful men who will be able to teach others also, to teach us to learn first, you know.
Let's go all the way in the back.
How many is on your ministry team? So, I don't know all you guys at all. How many is on this ministry team in Utah?
Do you want to introduce maybe the team?
Yeah, so right now, currently there's six pastors at Gospel Grace Church. Two were just ordained this last May. So for almost 7 years, it was the four of us, which were planting pastors.
Okay.
And then we, two of the guys who went through our internship program, one of them actually went from 1 year intern, 2 year intern, and then through elder candidacy, ordination, and now he's one of the six pastors currently. So those are the elder team. And then we have, how many interns do we have currently? We have three interns.
Three elder candidates.
And three elder candidates, which we can speak to the whole process. So the whole, if you say ministry team in terms of all of those, you're talking about 12 of us.
Okay.
Not, and the intention is that we don't want there to be a hoarding situation where they're all just going to just stick around and just we're going to all clump together, because the vision and the mission demands that we send out.
Are you individual mentors of guys?
Yeah,
we could talk maybe even a little bit more about that towards the end. A section in here on internship, we could talk about that a little bit, and elder candidacy. We've got two appendices in there where I try to outline those, but we could talk about that maybe as we get to the end. Was there another question?
Corey. Just seminaries using distance learning, would that be a vehicle you would be interested in at Gospel?
The question is, are we interested in distant learning with seminaries? I'll take it. Right now, how many guys are, there's probably six or seven that are doing some form of education, and it's all distance. So.
I just want to do a quick quote from Al Mohler. He said this: I emphatically believe that the best and most proper place for the education and preparation of pastors is the local church. Established pastors should be ashamed if they are not pouring themselves into the lives of young men whom God has called into the teaching and leadership ministry of the church. So Al Mohler, you know, president of Southern, says you should be ashamed of yourself if you're not pouring into and training in the context of your church. The reason I think that's a powerful quote is he's not saying, hey, send me all your guys. He's saying, get to work. That's what he's saying, and I think that's powerful. You want to add?
Well, I wanted to maybe push back on a little bit, not because I
you're going to disagree with Al Mohler?
No.
Someone get Al on the phone.
What I was wanting to bring up is that there could be several people in here who are very busy pastors. So they hear something like that and they agree with it. I want to do that, but how do we reconcile this gap between wanting to do it and then actually having the margin to be able to step? What would be some next steps toward that? Because it's a noble goal. We would agree. So I don't disagree with Mohler. I just think sometimes, you know, there's some reality check here.
Peter, what do you got? You got to add
kind of a follow-up or a way to rephrase the question, but Phil emphasized life on life in his last session.
Yes.
So could you just give some examples of things that you do, life on life ministry, you invest in young guys training to be leaders?
Okay, so the questions are kind of colliding with, like, how do you practically do this? You know, on one side you got a guy that's super busy, and then you just alluded to, you kind of soft pitched the ball. You know, how do you do that? Well, you kind of answered it with your question, which is life on life. So even the most busy of us can take somebody with us when we go somewhere. So we can take somebody with us when we go to a funeral, or we can take somebody when we do, you know, some form of, perhaps there's certain aspects of marriage counseling. We can take somebody with us when we disciple somebody else. They can be a part of a team discipleship. It's really, you kind of answered the question. Even the busiest of us can take people with us as we do life.
Maybe John, maybe you could just speak to what are some of the ways as a pastoral team we've kind of opened up channels for guys to be trained in context. So instead of like we created a new whatever, we've kind of opened up. What are some of those maybe you could share?
I think we tried to think of the things that we already were doing, and we tried to think of ways that we could include other people to listen in. So we have a team meeting every Tuesday night, and that's not pastors only. The interns and elder candidates are in on that, and they listen. And then that, whether it's a question in that time, or it's a conversation afterwards, or a conversation connected them later, that produces significant discussion. I think one of the things Will does is he's actually said that he wants to do not just one-on-one discipleship, but one-on-two or one-on-three. Yeah. And doing the little bit of extra work to help that person you're discipling find someone else that they want to bring in on that, connect with them. And what you're working towards is looking at the things that you're already doing and trying to bring somebody else alongside of it. Some of the other things, we try and use communication tools that work with busy lives. And so as simple as we use a voice walkie-talkie app, and we try and be accessible even in things like sermon prep. So where along the way of sermon prep, we'll talk about the text, talk about what we're doing with one of these interns or elder candidates, invite their input, study the text together, and then after delivery, talk about how it went and discuss back and forth. So Sunday review, simple, like we'll talk about Sundays, everything from how greeting and welcome went to announcements to whether or not the toilet's flushed properly to the sermon. But all of that is being handled not just pastor to pastor, but with these other men that are being raised up alongside us.
You know, for some of us, it was a paradigm shift, and that is that you can be driven by the urgent and neediest person in your church to spend the most amount of time. And actually, if you do a paradigm shift, you're going to invest into people that may not be the most urgent and needy, but have the greatest potential to be trained so that they can meet some of the urgent and needy. And then by doing that, you're actually multiplying your ability. So that's a paradigm shift. If you're constantly running around playing whack-a-mole, you will never have time to do leadership development because your leaders aren't the ones who you're having to play whack-a-mole with. So you're going to actually have to put some of those on pause, do some leadership development, and then bring that leader in to help you as you do some whack-a-mole and show them how to do it. So then all of a sudden you've got two people. Do you see what I mean? So it's a paradigm shift. Some of the other things we try to do is just fold guys in on some, so like preaching. Last week, one of our interns, his name's Joe. Joe prepped the same passage that I prepped for the week. He had an outline to turn in, and he did an evaluation on my sermon. So we have an evaluation form. After he prepped that text, he sat through my sermon. He gave me an evaluation, and then I got his outline, and then we got together.
Rachel passed. Did he?
You know, I had a couple marks that were a little low. He gave me a few little low marks, but we'll talk to him about that. but it was a fantastic, you know. So we spent 45 minutes together before another counseling appointment I had. He stopped by my house. We talked sermon together because he had prepped the text too. And it created a great conversation. So he has to do that four times by the end of the year with other preachers. And it's training him. You see, so we're just trying to fold in things, thinking creatively about how we can fold them into some of the stuff we're already doing.
Michael.
What I'm hearing you all say is, and what I'm hearing is a lot of leadership input into developing leaders. How have you seen it play out where your congregation helps develop those leaders? I mean, it's one thing to develop leaders. It's another thing for people to follow those leaders. How have you seen that play out?
The question is how, not just in addition to does the pastoral team develop leaders, but how does the congregation?
I mean, they're voting on elders. Right? I mean, so just how has that played out in your place?
Can I read you just a few lines to answer it? In your handout, I had Jotham write in third person. So it looks like someone was writing about him. But the part that says, this is going to begin on page... four, bottom of page four, a contemporary example of leadership development.
Jotham came to Gospel Grace the second week of that we were open, and then he just grabbed hold of everything and just started plowing into internship, and he's got an education, and now he's an elder.
So. Yep. So from coming to the U.S. from India, his second week in the U.S., he came to our second service. Of church planting and has been with us for 7 years and came as a single man who was a student at the University of Utah studying electrical engineering who liked SpongeBob WWE wrestling and wore black t-shirts and sweatpants every day.
That may or may not have been washed.
Yeah. he is a brother elder on our pastoral team. And what he writes, so he wrote in third person, but this is him writing, okay? This is him writing. So I say that so that these have some force to them. But he says on the middle of page 5, bottom of the first full paragraph, he says, Jotham, you can just say I. I was not merely discipled by the pastors at the church. I was discipled by the church itself. That's what he writes. And he writes that because over the course of his 7 years, actually, the church gave opportunities for him to serve in, and they were gracious and kind to him. Now, I don't know what you brothers felt like when you first started pastoring, but I know this. The first pastor, when I was a lead pastor down in Texas for almost 8 years, that church helped me become a pastor. They did. And they did it by being gracious with me and putting up with my mistakes and not always making the wisest decisions, but having to learn. And by praying for me and praying with me. You know what I mean? Those sheep helped me become a shepherd. And I think that's what he's communicating here in these 7 years. So he led a community group. So for years, he was discipling people and doing care for people. He started to teach adults. And so they would come and sit and learn and then ask him questions. And he started going to seminary. And just this process of him growing and learning, I think it was the way that the church allowing him to do that. In the end, he was unanimously affirmed by 11 elders in the valley who came together for his ordination council. They unanimously affirmed him without reservation to our congregation. And our congregation unanimously accepted him as an elder
100%.
Of our church, 100%. And we had almost 300 people come to our ordination council. I don't know about you brothers, but I actually am sickened by ordination councils in which two retired, half-asleep members of our congregation come, and somehow this ordination council is supposed to make a recommendation to the church family who didn't show up or didn't come or weren't invited. I think they should be able to vote on the suggestion the council gives to the church. And so we had almost 300 people there watching these guys for hours get grilled. I think they enjoyed it. You know, I think the church enjoyed it. And then unanimously voted to affirm as an elder. Did that answer your question?
Very much.
Yeah.
I thought something else. I think the structure of, and we know God's grace is, that's just what God's called us to do. It doesn't mean that everyone's supposed to do the things that God's called us to do. But there's enough little small group structures in the whole church. Specifically our community groups, but then, you know, things like during the summer we'll do we call it coffee and theology. It's about 40-some men get together, read a theology book, and then read a practical theology book and talk through it, but that's usually broken down as well. So you've got other slots. So there's just slots throughout the whole ministry for some of these guys to drift into. So like when you got 40 guys showing up for coffee and theology and you're breaking into 8 groups, naturally you're grabbing guys. And they're the ones that are driving that for, you know, 6 to 7 weeks throughout the summer.
And none of us led those groups.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, those are guys in the church leading those groups. And I think community group. And not only with community group, maybe you want to say, there, you know, you have the community group leader, but you also have an assistant, or what do you like to call it?
Apprentice.
Apprentice, who's growing in that. So I was sitting, I'm not leading a community group this year. I'm going to one, and two weeks ago, the apprentice led the group. So I'm sitting there as a pastor in somebody else's community group, and not even the community group leader led the group. So, I mean, I think those kind of things are happening organically, too.
Can I ask another question? I don't want to hijack it. But
can I follow that up real quick?
Sure.
One of the things that we, as we worked through the internship program, we didn't have a plan for elder candidacy or for bringing on these men onto pastoral team with us. And I think, just to be frank, there was a little bit of the four of us had served in pastoral ministry prior to coming to Salt Lake City, and we'd gone through deep waters together and developed some very strong relational ties because of that. And then we're looking at men that God was raising up in our congregation that were gifted, called, and equipped, qualified to be able to serve as pastors. And so I think the step that we had to walk through was being able to raise the ceiling on leadership development to say that there is a seat at the table with the pastors, and you won't be junior pastors or you won't be our staff, but we'll view you as pastoring alongside of us as brothers. And so I think that was a step that had to take place in our hearts in order to be able to take
it. And you know, when we added them to the communication thread, it's like, okay, yes, this is real.
Yeah, we don't have two text message threads with the four of us and then 6 of us, right?
And then the 2 of us.
And then the 2 of us. That gets into a whole another relational conversation, but I didn't want to say that. Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
So, when you talk about life on life, disciple making, often women are more conducive to that relational aspect. How do you and your church help cultivate leadership within women and their ability to lead other women and instruct the Bible?
That's a good question. The question is, how do we do that with ladies serving with ladies?
Well, we do a coffee theology. I'll just give you some examples. Okay, so one, summertime, we do something called coffee theology, and you have well 40 guys on one side, and then on another side of the building we got a bunch of ladies, 30-40 ladies, and they're breaking into small groups. They're doing discussion that way. We have mom to mom groups where older women. I mean, it's supposed to be Titus 2. So we
wait,
intentionally.
My wife is teaching that.
So is mine.
Oh,
okay. Where older women teach younger women, and we're seeing those connections. That was probably the most vibrant ministry of this last summer. We just launched called Mom to Mom. We had 18 women who were pregnant all at the same time. Somebody just gave birth this last year. I mean, there are all these babies coming everywhere. And so these brand new moms wanting some help, and it was fantastic. I mean, just the partnership with having, they were having maybe 30 to 50 ladies connecting at a park and mentoring taking place. Women's Bible studies and, I mean, there's all kinds of places for women to do discipleship that way and be equipped to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Luke?
Back this up a little bit. The calling, especially with this, the example you gave, it kind of seems like he is the one who presented an internal calling desire to ministry. Do you ever see the place for you to plant the seed of that calling, or is that all up to the Holy Spirit to say, here's the calling, and now he expresses it to the church, and you jump into it then? I'm just trying, what's the start process of this?
So the question is calling, and is it just, you know, the candidate expresses the calling of God in their life, or do we ever plant the seed in their heart? I think by way of illustration.
Yeah, there was a man in his mid-20s. His dad was a believer and never got plugged into a church. He watched David Jeremiah videos every Sunday. One day he was driving by and saw our church sign and decided to come in to church. And just immediately, it was evident that he was gifted in relational connection among people. He started what he called chatty Christians, which he got all the people in his age bracket in our church to join a text message thread that would just talk about Christianity and then talk about what they were doing. And they'd go to movies together and they'd go play volleyball together, and a community formed out of this. So this is a guy just shows up one Sunday. Has been coming to our church for a few weeks, and he's already really building community within our church. He was part of a community group, and it was evident that he was actually quite gifted and clear in presenting the word and ministering with the word. And people in the community group, though were older than him, would listen to how he handled the word. And so there were conversations that it was, you know, yeah. Do you want to grow in this?
Explicitly, you actually met with him and started going through him. What book did you go with him?
The Call to Ministry.
Yeah,
by the Al Mohler's Southern...
How many folks
manual.
Have you gone done that with?
Three.
Yeah, so John is he's grabbed three guys, and he's gone through a book on this Are You Called, basically. And he's just worked through that book with them.
And you initiated those,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it was the question of, hey, it seems like you really enjoy this. It seems like this is something in your life. Would you like to figure out if ministry is for you?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the answer to that question, it could be no, but... Wow, they've dug into understanding the work of the pastor and the responsibilities for caring for people, and you can pray for a pastor differently. You can use the gifts God's given you differently because you've been more equipped in the church.
It's a both and.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Any other questions?
Right here.
Yeah. Doran Pastor this morning was talking about the pietism that's pretty rampant in churches as a whole. I think one place that shows up is the call to ministry that, you know, we're talking about. Fortunately, there's some groups like Acts 20, I think Southern Baptist are taking a much more robust approach to evaluation. Have you guys ever evaluated somebody and said, we don't think you're cut out for ministry? And if you have, what triggered that? What steps? Was there kind of a backing off process? We think you need to work on this. If you don't improve, we're going to... withdraw that and tell you this is not for you.
Yeah. So we have a few, we have some checkpoints, or maybe you could call them off ramps, that would be possible for people that we're investing in that maybe have expressed interest in it. So if they've expressed interest in ministry, part of the on ramp would be to be part of our internship program. So we have a 2-year internship. There's evaluations every 3 to 6 months. So they get evaluated, sit-down meeting. I mean, it's like a formal feedback session. If we would get to year one after having 2 or 3 of those feedbacks that weren't going well, we would not renew them for year two. We would, and we'd make recommendations on it, you know. There's some where they would finish the internship and maybe be interested in eldership. This has happened. But there are some pieces of their life that maybe would not be conducive for them pursuing it right now. So a few examples, maybe a debt load that looks like to us would inhibit ministry. And so for us, we would say, we think you really need to pause and work on this debt load, because otherwise it will be a noose around your neck and you won't be free to serve the Lord. Or another one would be children and family. So, you know, going back to qualifications, we really feel like you need to have some focused work with your children, and we want to help you with that. But it would be with recommendations then of how to do that.
I think the key is getting out in front of those conversations before they happen, so they're not reacting to something. You already know that, you know, these things are going to come up, and you have these planned off-ramps. Not that that's the goal, but they're there when you need them.
Would you or have you told somebody, we think you can do this, but not here? For instance, let's say, you know, we think you demonstrate some character, but your leadership skills would be better suited for a smaller place, a different context. Okay. We just don't think you're good fit here.
Yeah, I think there could be, there's multiple reasons why that might be the case. So for one reason, there could be a chemistry thing, in the sense that there could be someone who is qualified for ministry, but we operate on a team ministry platform. So we have an elder team or a pastoral team, and sometimes it's a compatibility or a chemistry fit that may not actually be good for either side. And that might be one reason for someone that says, you're not disqualified for ministry, but it seems like your sync up would be with a different team. Another one could be organizational fit, and that is that their primary gift sets so overlap another member of the team that one of them would probably be dormant or stagnant in their gifting, and that would be another reason why we would suggest that maybe they go. And then third, we have a very large vision for a huge mission, and that is that we want to see multiple churches planted. So our goal is to train men up and send men out. Now, our first two elders that we affirmed, our church had grown to such a degree, and their heart burden was for our people. And so both of those collided, where we had opportunity, ability, and affinity, all coalesce such that those two men fit those places at just the time that we needed it providentially. However, we have other men that are in the pipeline that we're actually praying we can send. That's our goal, not to add another three. We have three men finishing elder candidacy. They've been through internship. They're finishing elder candidacy. And our hope, our prayer with them, for us, it's like Acts 13. We want to pray ahead of this curve, not always just be responding, but pray ahead that God will help us be able to send to needy areas. And so that's what we're praying for these guys. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, it's helpful.
Thanks.
The language we use on it is when we're going through elder candidacy and hitting ordination, that we ask them, do you feel like you're burdened to be an elder who goes or an elder who stays? What's your burden? And that's how we're using it.
There's not a third option yet.
Part of it stems from just concern. I think that our types of churches, by which I mostly mean churches, if we don't do a good job of telling people no.
Yeah,
so
correct.
You're right. You're not able. You're not whatever.
Yeah.
So that's why it's one of your problems.
I think, you know, to be fair, I mean, to be honest, I think when we first got going, you're just like,
you're breathing.
You're breathing. Your heart's going. And you're willing to go to Utah. Awesome. You know. And so we're probably out of the gate. Just got really. This last couple of years, the gate's gotten really narrow.
Yeah. So over here.
Just as a quick follow-up, because in your vision for church planting, you see you guys have a big vision, which is it's awesome, but six elders in one church, is it in your minds, is there a point where you say, this church is big enough, we have to start splitting off and actually sending these guys? We're not giving them a choice. We're just training you and you're going out. Mm-hmm. Is there a point, critical point where you say we're at mass?
Yep. The question is there a critical, is there a critical mass or is there a number by which in the congregation and in the leadership team that we've reached capacity and need to just send elders out? Yes?
Can you talk specifically about that?
So we're not going to send out people who aren't ready or aren't qualified just because we're full. That would be negligent and wrong. So we care about what we're sending out, who we're sending out. Are they ready and prepared and affirmed? So we won't just rush it. We're doing things right now that are really hard. We don't have enough parking. We fill blocks of street. We give bread and gifts to our neighbors because we fill all the streets all around because we don't have parking. It's not convenient right now. But we're praying and preparing and working hard to be able to send.
Well, we kind of thought internally, we did some number crunching of what the viable numbers are and stuff like that. And so we can tell some of the leadership. I mean, if they don't get sent out, mm-hmm. they're going to sour.
Stagnate, yeah.
And so we're going to we really have to. You know, that J.D. Greer book, Gained by Losing, you know, it's like you actually gain the spirit of what you're wanting to do by sending out. So, yes, there's just no way. So
I guess what I'm getting at is I know every context is different, but a church of 100 or 200 in the Midwest, should their goal be, we need to grow to have six elders before we think about planting, or should we plant right now?
So those six, by the way, those six elders, that equals about, is it three and a half full-time slots of money?
So we have bivocational.
I'm half, 80%, 80%, 100%, or
that's about right. Support from the church.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. And then we give a certain amount to the church. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Will you original four ever split off and plant elsewhere, or are you going to stay in the same gospel grace as a first generation?
So we're, what time are we done?
Yeah. I think that's a unique question because a shepherd's heart is to care for his people in such a way that they know that he can be trusted, depended on, it's safe to share their life with him. And so you want to be really careful in talking about where you're going and when and if, because the moment that you do that is the moment that people begin to say, well, there's a life expectancy with this relationship. And so I think that we're trying to be careful with that. I think there are elders, in particular, even the two that we just brought on, that have inclinations towards being sent. I think Jotham has burdens towards it. There's burdens that are there. But we also want to be careful that we care for the people that God's entrusted us well. So I think that's balance.
Yeah. We've also recognized this is a unique relationship God gave us. We're all very uniquely gifted differently. And so it's like there was such a dearth of Christianity in Salt Lake that we want to ride this as long as God has us to do that. But whatever.
Yeah. Okay, the idea of sending out a group of employees, you're saying you got guys finishing up candidacy, possibly going out on another team. Is that a team that they're going to go anywhere in Utah, or is it where you're going to be taking church family who's going to partner with that? Is it going to be more locally?
Yeah, we're burdened up really for Utah primarily. The I-15 corridor, you've got Orem and Provo, 600,000 people. Probably going to hit, in the next 10 years, going to probably push past a million. Then you got Salt Lake City Metro, which is 1.3 million right now. And then you've got Ogden, which is about 650. And then you've got another town of 125,000 north. So that's our burden area. If by God's grace there were 30 churches planted of 350, we'd move evangelicalism 1%. That'd be a dream.
Up to three and a half?
Yeah, it'd be 3.5% of the state would then be evangelical. And so if God would let us see that happen over 20 years, it'd be awesome. But, you know, most attainable right now is if there would be a family of churches of 5 to 7 churches that are cooperating together in that area to then replicate themselves. There'd be enough synergy, like 5 to 7 churches could then have a city seminary. You know, 5 to 7 churches then could facilitate some of those extra ancillary things that would help prepare long-term ministry in the Intermountain West.
So your intent in sending out a group, would it be to take church families from Gospel Grace who would go along with the team?
Oh, yeah.
Or are you, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
We would ask them, we help to revitalize a church that's about 30 minutes away from us, and we ask that team to actively recruit in our congregation that people would go with them.
And ask our people to pray about going. The only one who couldn't was my wife. She had to stay. But everybody else.
Yeah. Your kids could.
Yeah,
they're expensive.
Okay, well, if you want to hang out later and talk, we're happy to do that, but we'll end the session on time.